The following is an audio podcast from the Korea Society, celebrating more than a half century of promoting awareness, understanding, and cooperation between the people of the United States and Korea. For more information on our programs, please visit our website at www.koreasociety.org. This podcast is brought to you through the generous financial support of the Tongyang Group. In the areas of financial services and manufacturing, the companies of the Tongyang Group harness the passion and creativity of 12,000 employees worldwide to better serve their clients. The Tongyang Group, a global partner for Korean business.
On October 6, 2010, Dr. Marcus Noland, Deputy Director and Senior Fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, spoke to the Korea Society about the dynamics of the G20 summit and the issue areas that will be addressed.
It's a real pleasure to welcome all of you, and it's nice to see so many friends who have been here before, those who have spoken before, like Henry, as well as new friends, like our representative from the permanent mission of the Russian Federation to the United Nations, and this wonderful ability of those of us here in New York to borrow the wisdoms of those who serve in business as well as in public service. This morning is the second in our series of executive breakfast sessions that will address the November summit schedule in our series lead up to G20, Korea as a Convener and Innovation Economy. And we have on the line Dr. Marcus Noland, Deputy Director and Senior Fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Our first session explored the significance of the Seoul Summit and potential for institutional reform with Dr. Colin Bradford of the Brookings Institution, and with concluding comments by Henry Segerman, who's with us again here today. This follow-up discussion with Dr. Noland will address the dynamics of the G20 summit as far as its schedule and the issue areas to be addressed. To that end, I would recommend to all of you a most excellent write-up that Dr. Noland has done for the Center for U.S.-Korea Policy, which is a project of the Asia Foundation. That's available online, and Dr. Noland's article is really a wonderful short read called The Seoul G20 Summit, Opportunity for and Challenge to Strengthening U.S.-Korea Relations. So to those of you interested in its impact on our very critical bilateral relationship. Let me tell you just a few words about Dr. Noland, then we'll welcome him on the line. He is a Deputy Director of the Peterson Institute for International Economics and a Senior Fellow at the East-West Center. He was a Senior Economist at the Council of Economic Advisors in the Executive Office of the President and has held research or teaching positions at Yale University, Johns Hopkins University, the University of Southern California, Tokyo University, Saitama University, now the National Graduate Institute for Policy Studies, the University of Ghana, and the Korea Development Institute. He has written extensively on the economies of Korea, Japan, and China, and he is truly unique among U.S. economists in having devoted very serious scholarly effort to the problems of North Korea and the prospects of Korean unification. He was with us just this January to explain the impact of the currency reforms in North Korea for a very lively session to open our year. He won the 2000-2001 O'Hara Memorial Award for his book Avoiding the Apocalypse, The Future of the Two Koreas. He's a very keen observer of international economic development and, as we will hear this morning, the G20 process. Dr. Noland, welcome, and it's nice to have you online.
My pleasure. Sorry I couldn't be with you this morning. Congratulations on your great news. I am wearing my suit, but my two young twins kept me up last night, so I'm a little groggy.
I'm sure that's been twice the effort. Thank you. Marcus, we're really thrilled that you can be with us again twice in a year for the Korea Society, and we're very keen on hearing you lay out for us this agenda that we can anticipate and different aspects of it for this very interesting Seoul Summit to take place in November.
Sure. Let me just spend a few minutes discussing the agenda, and then we can open it up for questions and discussion. As you all know, the G20 G20 has effectively emerged as the steering committee for the world economy. And the shift from the old G7, G8 to the G20 signals the growing pluralism in the world economy and in international financial diplomacy, as well as the rise of Asia. The Seoul summit, which will come up on November 11th and 12th, will be particularly significant for two reasons. The first is that this is the summit that really marks the transition from crisis management to essentially systemic management. The earlier summits were born out of response to the global financial crisis, and were very much concerned with creating multilateral responses to that financial crisis. Now that the worst of the crisis appears to be behind us, the issue is how to move forward, how to set up the structures so that we don't experience such a crisis again. And that is really what the Seoul Summit will be about. And then one aspect of that is the shift in power and hopefully responsibility from the old dominant incumbent powers such as the United States, Western Europe, and Japan to a broader array of global economic powers. And in this respect, the Seoul Summit is quite symbolic. It is the first G20 summit to be held in Asia, and it's the first G20 summit to be held or hosted by a non-G7 country. So it really does represent the transition from the old to the new. The Korean hosts are framing the agenda for the summit around six themes. The first three of those themes represent continuation of work done in past summits. The first, and I don't want to say the most important, but the first and sort of central one is the issue of international macroeconomic coordination. In the past summits, the leaders committed themselves to strong, sustainable, and balanced growth. And what that means is basically a discussion of two things. One is the recommended fiscal policies among these countries. Now, the governments have committed themselves to reduction in reduction in their fiscal deficits and a stabilization of their overall debt to GDP ratios. But there is considerable disagreement and there's considerable consensus about the long run desirability of those actions, particularly in economies such as Japan or Western Europe, or to a lesser extent the United States, in which the demographics of the societies mean that there are going to be emerging and quite severe fiscal pressures driven by the healthcare needs of this growing elderly population. So I think there's broad, if not universal, agreement that a number of the members of the G20 really have to do something about their long-run fiscal positions. What there is less consensus about is what to do in the short run. And anybody who reads the op-ed papers of the United States simply gets the American version of this debate, whether we would be better off cutting the deficit now, a kind of anti-Keynesian move that supposes that the cut in the deficit will have a combination of confidence and anti-crowding out effects such that the private sector will more than offset the effect of the reduction in government expenditure, or whether you pursue a more traditional Keynesian policy of expansionary fiscal policy while the economy is weak. And that is exactly the sort of debate that we're having here in the United States. And in fact, that debate is occurring in many countries of the G20 and is an issue for discussion within the G20. I won't go into great detail about these sorts of things. They have The G20 has developed something called a macroeconomic assessment program, the MAP. They are as they say, taking ownership of the MAP at the current summit, in which they are supposed to create scenarios down to the individual country level that would basically start pointing directions for individual countries to take particular actions. So that's kind of the level of play. What is likely to be more controversial in this area, however, is the issue of exchange rates. External imbalances globally have generally been trending downward as a function of the recession. But with the revival of economic growth, or at least the stabilization of growth in others, those imbalances are rising again. And on current projections by organizations such as the IMF, they are predicted over the next couple of years to get quite wide once again. I think there is consensus among virtually all observers that exchange rate adjustment is part of the policy package of addressing external imbalances, though there is considerable disagreement about the emphasis on the exchange rate and the degree of exchange rate movement in various countries that is warranted. Obviously, the focal point in this discussion is China. And this is going to be a place that is going to put Korea, the host, into conflict with the United States. The United States is, from an overall standpoint, enormously supportive of the Korean effort. They want to see the Seoul Summit be a success because of our longstanding political relationship and indeed military alliance with Seoul. But on a number of the particular issues of the agenda, the hosts and the United States government, among others, don't see eye to eye. China is Korea's number one trade partner. The Koreans are quite reluctant to get into a debate about Chinese exchange rate policy at the Seoul summit. Indeed, the Korean finance minister the other day made a series of statements that raised eyebrows, to say the least, around Washington, basically saying that he thought that it was not an appropriate topic to discuss individual countries' exchange rates as opposed to some general kind of theoretical discussion of exchange rates. The Korean finance minister doesn't get to give the U.S. president orders, and so regardless of the preferences of the local hosts, I think it is fair to say that exchange rates will be a topic of discussion, indeed maybe a topic of significant disagreement at the summit. The second issue that is represents a continuation of the previous work program is the issue of financial regulation. And it is quite an extensive, multifaceted issue having to do with everything from bank capital adequacy regulations to how to resolve systemically important financial institutions, to what should be the proper role for ratings agencies, to what is the need for converging on a more universally accepted setting of accounting principles, and so on. It's a vast and highly multifaceted set of topics. In this area, the Korean, much of the locus of activity is actually being done at the Bank of International Settlements, the BIS, through something called the Ball Committee. And the Ball Committee released last month a report of recommendations for a new set of bank standards called Ball 3. And the Ball 3 standards do things like modestly strengthen capital adequacy requirements, as well as introduce liquidity requirements, and include a number of other provisions for defining various forms of capital and so on. I think that most observers would say that the Ball 3 is an improvement over Ball 2, but a lot of people think that it doesn't go far enough. And there is disagreements among the governments of the G20 about how much further to go. Some governments, particularly those with relatively weak banks, think these standards are adequate. They do not want to see further strengthening that of the standards that could cause them trouble in terms of their own banks. Other governments basically say our banks are fine and we're really not interested in getting into this, while there are yet other governments, including the United States, who I think would like to go further. I think that it is unlikely that the G20 will actually do anything concrete in this regard. And indeed, again, this is a case where the Koreans were hoping that Ball 3 would simply take the issue off the agenda, so to speak. I mean, they could simply celebrate the agreement rather than actually have to, you know, negotiate or work on the agreement. There may be some push among some governments to go further. The most likely political compromise is some statement that says, well, you know, some governments don't think these are adequate, and individual governments are free to move along further and go beyond Ball 3 if that's what they so desire. The third issue of the continuing work agenda is the reform of the international financial institutions, but really this is all about the IMF. I mean, in principle, it involves the multilateral development banks such as the World Bank and the Asian Development Bank, but really the focus is on the IMF. And again, there are a variety of issues in play having to do with the size or amount of IMF resources. Some of the governments want to have a substantial increase, indeed a doubling of IMF resources to fight future crises. Other governments are more skeptical. It has to do with some of the programs that the IMF has to deal with crises, and I will say a bit more about that in a second. And then finally, it has to do with internal governance. Basically, the internal governance structure of the IMF and these multilateral development banks more closely reflect the political realities of 1944 than they do 2010. In particular, within these organizations, there are weighted voting schemes. In the IMF, this is a function of what is called a country's quota, which is a measure of, in principle, how much money the country makes available to the IMF and how much money the country could draw from the IMF if it were in a crisis. And the quota is supposed to reflect the country's weight or significance or role in the world economy. So the United States has the largest quota, and you know, various countries have quotas you know, declining magnitude from there. In particular, Western Europe is grossly overrepresented in terms of these quotas. On the board itself, a number of smaller Western European countries are on the board, representing multi-country constituencies, of course, but nevertheless have their own individual seats. And so much of the discussion is how do you reduce the size of the board, consolidate the European seats in some fashion, free up a greater quota and greater weights for emerging markets and emerging countries in the world economy. And basically, it has come down to, it is effectively a debate between the overrepresented countries, which is a code word for Western Europe, and the underrepresented countries, which is a broader array of rising economic powers, with the United States in a relatively neutral position in all of this. Again, there were some internal deadlines in the works at the IMF. The Koreans were hoping that the IMF internal process would take care of this before they got to Seoul. And again, the host would be able to lead a celebration of the decisions that had been made rather than actually having to work on trying to hash out decisions. That still may happen. I wouldn't bet on it. And so it is quite possible that in Seoul, the Koreans will be in the middle of trying to referee some kind of reform of the international financial institutions. But the IMF in particular. One thing I should also add is not only in terms of the internal governance or the issues that I mentioned, but you have the symbolic issue that the managing director of the IMF by tradition has been a European. The president of the World Bank by tradition has been an American. The head of the Asian Development Bank is a Japanese, Japan, the United States being the largest shareholders. There are desires to eliminate this job reservation system and move to something more based on merit as well. I think that's desirable. It's probably and will probably be a component of some reform package, but it's not the most important. The nationality of the leader is not the most important issue on the agenda. So those are the three big things: the macroeconomic coordination, financial sector reform, and reform of international financial sector institutions that are the continuing work agenda from the previous summit. To that list, the Koreans have promoted three issues as being major agenda items. Now, some of these have been discussed in the past. It's not that they're completely new, but in some cases, the Korean hosts want to elevate the prominence of these issues on the agenda. And those three issues are what the Korean government is calling the global financial safety net, the issue of trade, and the issue of development. Now, the global financial safety net is really a Korean innovation to this summit. Korea was adversely affected in the financial crisis. The exchange rate fell by about 50% during the crisis, though fortunately Korea was spared enormous amounts of macroeconomic dislocation. But the Korean perspective is that if a good, well-managed economy like Korea can be hit by this crisis, then there has to be a better sort of safety net for those countries that they can call upon that could both provide them with a cushion, but also potentially prevent crises by making speculators or others recognize that there are all these resources that are latently available to the country, and as a consequence, crises don't happen to start with. The flip side of that is that Korea, as well as a number of other countries, particularly in East Asia, have accumulated a lot of foreign reserves over the last decade or so. In the case of Korea and some of the East Asian countries, it's perhaps this self-insurance, so to speak, is perhaps an understandable response to the crisis of 1997-1998, where they were caught without enough foreign exchange reserves, so the response is to accumulate a lot of foreign exchange reserves in order to self-insure. The problem is that self-insurance and mercantilism are observationally equivalent. You can't, when a country is running current account surpluses and accumulating surpluses and intervening in its exchange markets to keep the exchange rate from appreciating, which is not something the Koreans have done to a great extent, but some other countries have, from the outside, from the countries that are essentially being forced to run deficits, it's not clear if this is in some sense an understandable, though perhaps regrettable, instinct for self-insurance, or if this is simply mercantilism, trying to maintain employment at home through exports and essentially exporting unemployment to the rest of the world. So from the standpoint of the deficit countries like the United States, there could potentially be some interest in a global financial safety net if it were part essentially of a grand bargain, in which, on the one hand, you would have this enhanced set of institutions to provide for these financial rescue packages, with the quid pro quo being countries would not engage in some of the policies they've engaged in over the last 10 years because there would no longer be a need for self-insurance. It's not clear how this in some ways is related to the issue of IMF reform. One of the reasons countries say that they have to have self-insurance is because of so-called stigma, that the experience of going to the IMF in 97-98 was so traumatic that no government could possibly imagine doing it, so that although in principle a country like Korea or some other country could call on the IMF for support, in political reality, they can't or won't do so because of the so-called stigma. And that is one justification for self-insurance. So one of the things the IMF has been trying to do, and a sort of thing that also comes up in the Korean proposal, are proposals for ways of accessing funds that involve less conditionality. So there are proposals, there are actually facilities now for pre-approval, that countries kind of get the good housekeeping seal of approval in advance, and you know that they have a pot of so many billions of dollars of a foreign exchange they can draw upon, and so if you're a speculator or if you're just a local citizen who's scared, you know that there's that pot of money out there, so maybe you don't really have to move your money because everything's going to be all right. The Koreans want to add to that with an enhanced role for bilateral swap agreements, such as the United States Federal Reserve has with the Bank of Korea, regional swap arrangements, such as the East Asian countries, including Korea, have through the Chiang Mai initiative, as well as kind of other mechanisms. The Koreans believe, based on their experience in the most recent crisis, that the bilateral swap agreement with the United States was very important. That in some ways, the $30 billion the billions of dollars that the United States was willing to make available to the Koreans was worth more than the same amount of money the Koreans had themselves. Now, as an economist, this does not strike me as intuitively obvious, that $10 billion of Federal Reserve money ought to have a bigger impact on the market than $10 billion of Bank of Korea money. What the Koreans, it seems that many people during the crisis believed that the Bank of Korea was committed to maintaining a level of $200 billion of reserves. So as the amount of Korean reserves began eroding from about 260 to 250 to 240 to 230, if you believed they weren't willing to touch anything beyond 200, then in fact their amount of reserves were declining fast, and a commitment, say, of $10 billion by the United States would actually be a big marginal commitment if you were already at 230 or 220. That's one possibility. And so the problem that Korea faced was not so much that there was a lack of dollars, but the market perceived them as being unwilling to use some of the dollars they already had. What some Koreans will respond is that that's not exactly right. That, they had all these assets, but they were held in U.S. dollars, often in U.S. banks. It was a financial crisis and a banking crisis in the United States. So selling, you know, pulling reserves out of American banks and selling the dollars in the midst of the crisis would not be the smartest thing for them to do for either an economic or political reason. And so it was the nature of the crisis that restricted their ability to use their dollars, not some sort of obsession among the Korean policymakers that they needed $200 billion. Either way, the lesson the Korean hosts have taken away from this is that these multilateral commitments are very important, and they're going to be pushing to expand them. The fifth issue is the issue of trade. Now, the problem that both the Korean hosts and all the other participants face is that the focal point of trade negotiations is the Doha round of negotiations under the auspices of the World Trade Organization. And as I'm sure all of you know, the Doha negotiations are more or less stalled, dead in the water. And so the pledges to bring these things to this negotiation to a close is starting to gain a kind of ritualistic or incantatory sort of sense that this is some sort of, you know, ritual, I don't want to say prayer, but some kind of chant that leaders make at meetings. And the problem is, having raised the issue on the agenda, what do you do? What can you actually do? One of the things that the leaders have done is pledge a standstill. No more and no new protectionist actions. And one of the relatively positive things over the last few years has been the relatively modest protectionist response that has been observed to this crisis. So surely one of the things the leaders will do will reaffirm their pledge of no new protection, no new restrictions on investment. They may even put in some kind of mechanism to more formally name and shame miscreants, as well as perhaps praise virtuous countries that remove protection. So there are some things that G20 can do among itself, but frankly speaking, they are more defensive kind of stopgap measures, not really pushing the system forward. There's been a renewed interest in recent weeks among some of the finance ministers, though not all, as well as the WTO itself, about trying to rejuvenate the Doha negotiations with a renewed emphasis on services negotiations, which might be of interest to this particular audience. So there may be some kind of deal made at Seoul to rebalance the Doha agenda so services liberalization gets a more prominent profile, and that is hailed as the mechanism for trying to break the Doha logjam. The final issue that the Korean hosts have put on the agenda is the issue of development. Now, technically speaking, this is not new. The G20 summits have always said something about development. In Toronto, the previous summit, there were pledges made about maternal health in developing countries. But the Koreans have really raised the profile of the development issue. They see themselves, and they are justifiably proud of the experience of Korea over the last 50 years, really being the first country to go from developing to developed country status. And they believe that this gives them particular insight into the challenges of developing countries. And they wanted to promote the issue of development for that reason, as well as the fact that the G20, while being broadly representative of the world economy, is not a universal group. And there are many countries that are not at the table, many of which are poor countries. So the Koreans have emphasized the development issue. They have quite an elaborate agenda of, I believe, seven pillars of development, various sorts of things they want to emphasize within the development rubric. But personally, I do not think this was necessarily a good idea for two reasons. One, development itself is very multifaceted. It lends itself to a very diffuse sort of agenda, and it could become a way, frankly, to dodge the harder issues. It could provide a platform for governments to talk to basically try to paper over or disguise the fact they haven't come to important agreements in financial sector regulation or exchange rates or some other issue of the more ongoing core agenda. So I think that the issue there's an element of potential mission creep involved. The other problem, of course, is that developing countries aren't at the table, and so for the most part. And so there is a bit of the problem the G7 used to face, where, well, we're going to make pronouncements on development that largely affect people who are not here at this meeting. And there's a kind of a political optical problem there as well. Having said that, fortunately, the Korean hosts have framed the issue around growth and resilience. Achieving significant growth rates and then maintaining them. And I think that what 50 years of development research can demonstrate is that GDP growth alone does not necessarily bring development as we understand it, if it's not a sufficient condition, it is certainly a necessary one. If you don't have growth, you're not going to get development. So I think that at least having brought the issue to the fore, the hosts are framing it in the appropriate manner. Finally, there's an issue that's not on the agenda, but the leaders, they are the leaders of these countries, and they can talk about what they want. and it may push its way onto the agenda, and that's the issue of climate change. There is a climate and energy component of past G20 summits. It's not been a particularly prominent one. But there is reason to anticipate that it might have greater prominence this time around. The reason is that the Seoul summit comes not long before the Cancun Ministerial, which is the first meeting of the UN climate system negotiations or consultations after Copenhagen. Copenhagen did not deliver in the ways that people would like. The next meeting is this Cancun Ministerial. Some of the countries may want to use the Seoul summit to discuss some of the issues going into Cancun. Again, it's not an issue that the Koreans are pushing, but you have 20 heads of government at these meetings, and you know, if the heads of government want to talk about the issue, then they can, and it's quite possible that they will. So I've gone on for much, much longer than I had originally anticipated, and so I think it's best that I now stop and that we open up to a broader discussion.
Thank you, Dr. Norman. A very rich overview. And you're already getting applause, so we really do appreciate that. I would like, in that this is a business roundtable, to open it up to any of our talented voices here at the table.
And please wait for the microphone.
Please. Any questions for Dr. Nolan? Marcus, on a couple of things that come to mind here as we're circulating the microphone and formulating questions. Your comments with China, especially relevant compared to the political front. And last week at a trilateral meeting of policy observers from Japan, Korea, and the United States here at the Korea Society, and managed by the National Committee on American Foreign Policy, there was a great deal of discussion about the growing levels of discomfort, not only between China and the United States, but certainly the follow-on impact for Korea. And so I'm kind of wondering if you have any instinct on how this plays out on the exchange rate front, other than, you know, obviously your observation about the finance minister having to take a back seat to the U.S. president's protocol on it. But do you think it'll be basically a contentious debate that sees much progress, or hard to say at this point?
That's really a great question, because the instinct let me introduce a term that some of you may be unfamiliar with, because I've gotten really quizzical looks when I've used it, including at the dinner table. The point man or point woman for each government in the organization of this summit is called a Sherpa. I don't know why. I actually meant to look it up on Wikipedia or something, try to find out why they're called Sherpas. But anyway, they're called Sherpas. And the Sherpa for the host country, Korea, is a very, very capable economist named Ri Chung-young. The instinct of the finance ministries and the Sherpas is going to be to insulate these discussions from those political and diplomatic matters. I mean, that is just pure bureaucratic instinct. And so, interestingly enough, in the discussions I've had with the organizers of the summit and other involved groups, the sorts of issues that you raised has not come up. They want to treat this very much as a kind of almost technocratic exercise. Now, of course, they don't get to control their president. And the president will have people, most obviously from the foreign ministry, who are going to want to discuss these issues and are going to want to use the opportunity of the face-to-face meetings of heads of government to discuss these issues. So I think probably what's going to happen is those sorts of things will certainly be kept off the formal agenda, which is being controlled by the finance ministries. But there will be pressure or desire by the foreign ministries to discuss these issues, either in the formal meetings or possibly more likely in informal, or I shouldn't say informal, but bilateral or possibly small group face-to-face meetings outside of the plenary sessions of the full G20. So I'm sure the issues will be discussed there, and it may get quite acrimonious given the kind of a tone of diplomacy over the last month or so in Northeast Asia. But I would not anticipate those things being on this agenda, because I think the finance ministries will probably be successful in keeping it off the formal full group agenda.
Mm. Very interesting, please. And if you could identify yourself and your institution.
Good morning, Dr. Nolan. Thank you for your comments. My name is Joseph DeMarco. I'm a partner in the law firm of DeVore & DeMarco here in New York. And my question is this. If you could get inside the heads of the Korean leaders who will be at the summit, what would you think are the two or three most important things that they want to see come out of the summit? What are kind of the milestones of success from their vantage point? And then as a follow-up question to that, do those two or three or four things align with, or are they in conflict with, what the American leaders at the summit want to see?
Okay. That's a really interesting issue, because it's a very interesting question. In some of the meetings that I've been involved in the run-up to this, where you stand is a function of where you sit. And the economists and the career finance ministry officials and the central bankers and, you know, the BIS crew and, you know, the people who do technocratic work on economics issues have an agenda which they see as important, which is largely could be encapsulated in that first three set of issues I mentioned of macroeconomic coordination, including exchange rates, financial sector reform, and international financial institution reform. And if you asked them, depending on the individual, you would get, you know, some different answers. But, for example, if I ask my own colleagues, I think the three things they would say would be something on exchange rates, including from China, something on strengthened bank capital and liquidity requirements, and an expansion of IMF resources. Those would be the three issues that they would say are the three most important issues for the summit to address. If you talk to the political advisors, however, they have a very different agenda. Their agenda is to make their bosses look good. So you want to have a summit that does not have a lot of acrimony, and you want to have a summit in which you can announce new things, and best yet, if it's new things that your domestic public actually cares about. So from a Korean standpoint, as far as I can tell just from my interactions, the number one goal, the number one desire, is an absence of acrimony. They would like to have the ball-free agreement accepted at face value. They would like the IMF to figure out all its own internal governance stuff before anybody gets to Seoul. And they would like, the exchange rate issue to disappear. And, so that the summit would be, this sounds pejorative, but almost a cheerleading type thing. You'd be celebrating all the great cooperation. You'd be celebrating all the great accomplishments. And then there might be particular things the Korean public is interested in, or that Korea could say is our own. And these would be in most likely in that area of global financial safety nets, where you could say we've got some sort of agreement on global financial safety net. That is something that we came up with. That's our idea. And it's something that benefits the Korean economy, because with this new global financial safety net, we will never again experience a crisis in which our exchange rate falls by 50%, despite the fact that we've been carrying on our affairs in a prudent manner. So I think there's probably a disjunction between what, in some ways, the technocrats would like to see as objective progress on difficult issues, and what political advisors would like to see. you know, as things that they can sort of sell to their public. So if you take the political advisors list that I gave, what was that? First of all, avoiding all acrimony. Well, that's going to bring Korea into conflict with the United States, because the United States may not be really enthusiastic about going beyond ball three, and IMF reform is kind of an inside baseball game for most Americans, or inside baseball. The Chinese exchange rate's not. We're considering punitive legislation here in the United States. So the idea that you can just sweep this completely under the rug is just not going to fly with the United States government. So that's one area that potentially brings the United States and Korea into conflict. What is the second one? Global financial safety nets. The global financial safety nets, boy, if IMF reform is inside baseball, global financial safety nets from a standpoint of the American political system has got to be super inside baseball. It's not something that most Americans or even members of Congress would get very excited about. Some of the things that the Koreans want to do seem to be sensible. You know, bilateral swaps. I mean, the United States already has a bilateral swap with Korea as well as some other countries. Multilateral swap arrangements. The United States is relatively copacetic on the Chiang Mai initiative, and you know, it wants it to be consistent with the broader global architecture. But as long as that's the case, the United States is relatively relaxed. Some of the IMF programs, there are concerns about moral hazard, that if these programs get ever bigger and with less and less conditionality, then there is the prospect that, you know, that moral hazard kicks in and the crises will ultimately be bigger crises. Where the specific conflict with the United States will come in is on IMF resources. We can sit here and argue this morning about whether increasing the resources available to the IMF or the multilateral development banks is a good or bad idea. In the current political climate of the United States, I think those appropriations are going to face uphill sledding in the U.S. Congress. And so that is one area where the Koreans' desire as part of this overall reform to expand the resources of the IMF would come in conflict with the United States. But I don't think that's necessarily something that if I was the president of Korea, I would be necessarily trying to sell to my public, since the IMF is not a particularly popular institution there anyway. So in that area, although there may be some policy conflict, I don't think the political conflict would be particularly high, because I don't think the issue is particularly salient in either country.
Very good. Andrew?
Henry Segerman, Korea International Investment Fund. You mentioned a couple of issues regarding acrimony and possible disruptions internally, but no comments about potential external disruptions. So I wanted to ask you what you thought about two possible external disruptions. As we saw in Toronto and Seattle and almost everywhere the G20 convenes, there's a lot of street demonstrations, and we do know that the left views globalization as a vast American, Western European conspiracy. And
it is, isn't it?
If you look at the Korean left in particular, based on these made-up allegations about mad cow disease, you had, I don't know, about 250,000 people out in the streets there. So they are deliriously protectionist on the Korean left and ready to rush out in the streets. I saw a picture in the newspaper today of Korean riot policeman smashing 20 bricks with his forehead, practicing. So I guess the Korean police and maybe the army are pretty worried about that. And 3 weeks ago, I had lunch with a consular official who told me that they were all terrified of a North Korean provocation during the G20 after the Cheonan incident and all of the power juggling going on up there. do you think there might be a possibility, this question number two, of Ri Yong-ho ordering some sort of northern limit line crossing or something like that, just to kind of like keep those South Koreans on their toes? I know that there was a little conflab in Panmunjom about 6 weeks ago, and basically they just said, we want you to get rid of that northern limit line, or, you know, just nothing friendly, and the only point that came up was how much they hate the northern limit line. So that led me to believe that the next game on the part of Ri Yong-ho and whoever is running the place would be naval again. So what do you think of the two issues?
Well, our institution is co-sponsoring, along with the Asian Development Bank and the South Korean Presidential Commission for the G20 Seoul Summit, a conference in Seoul later this month on the summit agenda and preparations. And so every time there's one of these newspaper articles about the North Koreans potentially disrupting the summit or making some mischief, I circulate it to the delegation of people from the Peterson Institute who are traveling for Seoul. And of course, this is sort of teasing people. And I've had a colleague, wonder if he needs to get additional life insurance and so on and so forth. And we sort of think it's amusing. But the director of our institution, Fred Bergson, actually asked me, well, really, what do you think is going to happen? So let me tell you what I've been counseling our people internally. But first, let me say, this is a really sad issue in the following sense. Initially, the South Korean government was talking about bringing the North Koreans in as observers. There is a kind of tradition that has grown up at these summits that the hosts kind of get a couple free passes that, that they use to mollify allies who are not part of the group and hence wouldn't be, in the room or at the table or whatever. And maybe a year ago or so, the South Koreans were actually talking about using their kind of free pass as the host to actually invite in the North Koreans to sit there as observers and see what this whole thing is about, see that it involves a lot of technocratic discussions, see that it involves discussions among the heads of government, that it's not some sort of conspiracy against North Korea, it's not, and so on, and basically as a process of socializing them into the broader global community. And I think it's really unfortunate that the diplomacy on the peninsula has really gone downhill over the last, a year ago was probably too long ago, but over the last 7-8 months, when that discussion was initially occurring, that it'd be inconceivable at this point that South Korea would invite the North Koreans in. So in some ways, it's not just what might the North Koreans do to disrupt, but it's what they lost, the opportunity that was lost by this behavior over the last number of months. So when Fred Bergsten, or one of my colleagues who's going with me to Seoul later in the month, asks me, well, what do you think they actually will do? My quick answer is, I would not be at all surprised if they funnel money to protesters. I would be surprised if they started shooting artillery. If you're going to do a provocation, my expectation is that the provocation would come before rather than during the summit. I think if you tried something during the summit, it would simply be regarded as too threatening and almost surely would backfire in terms of hardening the attitudes of a broader group of countries against North Korea. If you start threatening military actions while the head of government is in town, I don't think most governments can react very well to that. And so a lot of countries around the world that are in the G20 that probably don't have really strong opinions about North Korea, that would probably be what formed their opinion about North Korea. So I don't think from a tactical standpoint it would make sense to do something during the summit. If you're going to do something, it's better to do it before the summit. So, you know, a week or two ahead of times, you could do something, I think, with the hope of disrupting Korean financial markets, and then creating a kind of air of anxiety or lack of security during the summit itself. What I think is more likely, however, is probably underground or surreptitious support for street protests. This is not to deny that large numbers of South Koreans hold the views that you attributed to them, and that they are certainly able to protest in the street without North Korean encouragement. I want to be quite clear. I'm not arguing that this is some sort of, you know, North Korean front activity or something. But on the other hand, we do know, and partly from my own conversations with these people about their own experiences, especially during the student protest periods, that the North Koreans do infiltrate these groups. They do provide financial support. And so it wouldn't be at all surprising to me if they try to encourage this activity. Now, whether the actual impact they have in encouraging it makes a protest that would have been 100,000 people, 200,000 people, or if it makes a protest that would have been 100,000 people, 101,000 people, I don't know. My instinct is that it's towards the latter, that if you see protests in the street, those reflect the genuine views of the South, you know, parts of the South Korean public, however misguided you or me or Steve or other participants this morning may think of those views. I think they're probably genuinely held, and, you know, that's possible. I guess the thing that I'm curious about, and I'm probably the worst person to comment on this, and virtually everyone who is participating in this morning is probably better placed than me, is whether the instinct to protest, which will dominate, the instinct to protest or the instinct for Korea to look good. It seems to me that there is this sense, and I suspect it's probably pretty broadly held in the Korean public, that this is a big deal. Korea is hosting the heads of government of the 20 biggest, most important governments in the world. It's the first time this has happened in Asia. It's the first time this has happened in a kind of non-traditional incumbent power. This is a big deal for Korea. It's probably not as big deal in terms of Korea's image in the world as the 1988 Olympics were, but nevertheless, this is a big deal. And my guess is that most Koreans want to see it succeed. And so, you know, regardless of what they may think about Lee Myung-bak or, you know, Barack Obama or anybody else, I think there probably is at some level a sense of national pride that this is a big deal, a big event. They're the hosts. They want to see this go well. Obviously, not everyone's going to be part of that consensus, and I'm sure there'll be protests. I see this going a little more smoothly than maybe some people do. When I do PowerPoints, I always try to have pictures, because I hate those PowerPoints that just have words. I mean, you know, I can read faster than people can talk. And so it's nice to have photos of protests and stuff to illustrate, you know, anti-globalization. I definitely want to find the protest of the guy breaking bricks with his head. I think that you know, that will definitely make it into my next PowerPoint.
I think it was in the New York. It was in the New York Times this morning, or Wall Street Journal yesterday, or Financial Times yesterday. So it's just came out, and it's not 20 bricks. It's 20 sort of, they look like thin pieces of rock or something.
Yeah, that's those little things they use when they do that. But you know, we have we're here in Washington, our local baseball team is the Nationals, but up the road they have the Baltimore Orioles, and Brian Roberts, possibly the best player on the Orioles, gave himself a concussion the other night by hitting himself over the head with a baseball bat. So I think people that bang their heads against bricks and walls and baseball bats, I personally, I've never done it, but I would be interested in seeing the photo.
Ma'am, you had a question. Yes, please.
And this will be our last question this morning.
Dr. Noland, I know very well what a Sherpa is. The Sherpas are the people, the local people in the Himalayan regions, and they are the ones who help Edmund Hillary and his successor in climbing Mount Everest and other mountains in that region. And since organizing a G8 or G20 summit is more or less like climbing Mount Everest, given the riots that unfortunately surround these events, that's why the Western leaders call their assistant in this endeavor Sherpas. But anyway, my question has to do with climate change. How much, what kind of effect will it have for the climate change to host the summit in Asia and in Korea, vis-a-vis what happened in Copenhagen, the disaster of the Kyoto Agreement, etc.? Do you think that there will be some push from the host country and other Asian countries in making finally some effective changes?
That's a good question. I think the Koreans are very enthusiastic about enthusiastic about climate change is probably not right, the right way to put it. They are enthusiastic about addressing the issue of climate change for two reasons. One, I think there's actually a genuine desire in Korea to address the problem, and there is a great interest in all things green in Korea. And I think there's also a commercial interest. Green technologies are something that Korean firms are developing. They see that as a potential market that they can sell. And so I think there's both a genuine desire to address climate change as well as some commercial interests involved. So I think the Koreans are generally pretty enthusiastic about it. The problem that G20 faces is that it can't really negotiate climate change issues because it's not universal, and in particular, it doesn't include some of the, and I'm going to not remember the correct phrase, but these highly vulnerable countries, I mean, such as island countries that, you know, will go underwater if, you know, polar ice caps keep melting and so on and so forth. They're not there at the table. So you can't really negotiate. For better or worse, we're on a track in which negotiations, whether it be over, you know, of whatever sort, is got to go through the UN system. That said, the G20 countries represent a huge share of the global economy, and they include some of the worst polluters. And so if you can get progress on those issues, while it may not be the universal binding sort of progress that you could get through the UN system, it may actually have significant impact. And there are things that the G20 can do in terms of G20 commitments to reduce emissions. There are things that the G20 can do to accelerate the deployment of clean energy technology, which the hosts Korea may be particularly interested in. And there are things the G20 can do to help mobilize both public finance as well as private financial resources for a variety of sorts of mitigation and adaptation. So I think that it's an active area within the G20, and they've had these discussions on energy and taxes and climate change. I think it is something that in some ways plays to the Korean strengths, and would be, you know, relatively popular within Korea. But it also is an issue that there's a bit of awkwardness, given the existence of the UN process. So I would expect to the extent that it kind of elbows its way onto the agenda, that it be in the sorts of things that I've been talking about, or kind of pre-negotiations, kind of teeing up whatever might subsequently happen in Cancun. I mean, after all, you've got the United States, you've got China, you've got India, you've got the Western Europeans, you've got the South Africans and the Brazilians. I mean, you've got the key large countries there. And they could hash out some kind of consensus, but then that's got to be translated to the UN process. And I think when you try to do that, there may be some resistance from countries that were not part of the G20 who don't want to be handed a fait accompli. But I think there's clearly room for progress. I think it's something that, you know, as I said, we'll play the Korean strengths. But I think that the G20 has the capacity for doing a lot of good in this area, but it doesn't have the capacity for negotiating some sort of global treaty in this area.
Thank you, Dr. Nolan. It's been a very rich hour, and we're very, very grateful for your time and your very thoughtful observations this morning. Ladies and gentlemen, please help me thank Dr. Marcus Nolan.
Thank you. It was a great pleasure.
Thank you, Marcus. I also wanted to offer a few words of thanks to some of the people who made this happen. Natalie from our program staff has done tremendous efforts on this and the entire series, as well as a number of other wonderful programs we have here this fall. To Daniel, our director of media, and to Peter for their kind support on the technical aspects. They will be making this available as a podcast and as a transcript. And so we invite you to visit www.koreasociety.org, where you can also sign up for membership, and we invite you to please do that. You will see out front a calendar of events that does show the remainder of our activities for the fall. It's been a very rich one so far. I'm happy to report that last week our figures for those attending Korean film at MoMA were 3,493 and another 500 at BAMS. So the attendance and the demand and interest in Korea on a wide variety of fronts has been very impressive. Please join us again on October 20th as we do the third in our series on this G20 summit. And I'd invite any of you interested in the arts to view our exhibition currently on display, which closes this week, as well as to attend tomorrow evening at 6:30 a concert around that exhibition and around Korean traditional music, which will be in this room, and that is called Autumn Leaves and Stone Gardens, A Musical Journey, and we invite you to bring your family and friends for that. Also, a week from tomorrow, a week from Thursday, we will have the opening of Through Eastern Windows, Prints by Elizabeth Keith, and Traditional Korean Hats. We thank you. We thank our sponsors in the Tongyeong Group who make this available via podcast, and you'll see a rich menu of podcast recordings available on our site. And we'd also like to thank you for joining us in the Samsung Intercultural Center, and we thank our Samsung sponsors for that. Thank you all, and we hope to see you again very soon.
The opinions expressed in the preceding program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Korea Society, its staff, management, or sponsors. Thank you for listening to this Korea Society podcast. If you enjoyed it, please consider becoming a member. Visit www.koreasociety.org for information about memberships and to learn more about all the programs available at the Korea Society.